Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website www.thecritic.co.uk to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this edition, Professor Jeremy Black, whose books include Naval Warfare, A Global History Since 1860, and Combined Operations, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the reach and organisation of Britain's armed forces in protecting and expanding the British Empire and expeditionary campaigns around the world in the Victorian era.
Professor Jeremy Black, in the 40 years or so between the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the Crimean War, the British Army seem to have stagnated in terms of reforms and innovation under the leadership of the great Iron Duke, the Duke of Wellington. Is that a fair perception? It was continuing to fight what we might now call minor wars. They may not have seemed minor for those fighting them at the time. Surely lessons were being learned continually throughout that period, and adaptation was taking place.
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the usual line that is taken is that the British didn't do terribly well in the Crimean War, and that therefore this proved that their army was in a mess. I certainly don't think they did terribly well at the outset of the Crimean War, but often armies didn't do well, same navies actually, in the opening campaigns of a war. My own view is that the classic features of the 18th century and early 19th century British Army and British military as a whole was its wide-ranging capability, its ability to operate within Europe and outside Europe. And that, I would say, remained the case in the period we're talking about. What that meant, of course, is that an army which, shall we say, was a relatively modest size had obvious problems if it was to be obliged to take on a major continental power. But yes, I think sometimes that there is an exaggeration of the failings of the British Army. And this is part and parcel of a general Victorian pattern, which you see at church state and in other respects, which is to argue that the Ancien Regime was anachronistic, redundant, etc., 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 and that you needed major new Victorian reforms in order to improve matters. Well, I think we can ask a whole host of questions about that analysis. I think it's often a misreading of the prior situation. After all, it wasn't as though the British Army did terribly in, for example, 1812 to 1815. So it's a misreading of the prior situation. I think it can be a misreading of the benefit of what we call reform. And I think it's too simple a unidirectional pattern of history. So I'd be a bit wary of that one.
What was the driving strategy with the British Army during this period? There's a long hangover of fear about a standing army and therefore wanting to have a small army, and also a natural focus on the Royal Navy. Is there a sense, though, that India can be left to the East India Company regiments and that really all is needed is a smallish force which can be upscaled, come a major continental engagement? Or what are the driving assumptions?
That again is an excellent question. I'd say the driving assumption is that Britain's defence and interests fundamentally rely on the Navy, and the Navy is fit for purpose. Indeed, in the after the Napoleonic Wars, in the first 15 years after that period, there is the dramatic intimidation, bombardment of Algiers. There's the Battle of Cape Navarino, the last battle of the Age of Fighting Sail. And there is the British Navy starting to develop steamships. And in the beginning of the 1840s, the Navy proves well up to power projection into Chinese waters and up Chinese rivers, the Yangtze. So the Navy, I think, comes number one. Number two, as far as the army is concerned, there is a wish after the Napoleonic Wars dramatically to reduce the size of expenditure. The army is cut. which in fact is a form of efficiency, because very large force would not have been easy to use. And I would say that the army as a force of, is it as it were, separate regiments sent on particular tasks remains pretty good. And I've used the example of China. I think the British military did quite creditably in the early 1840s in the so-called First Opium War. Obviously, there are dramatic failings. The First Anglo-Afghan War, at least initially, is not a brilliant success. But I think we know enough about our recent experiences in Afghanistan to not necessarily argue that modern militaries are ipso facto more effective, even though they have better technology.
The Duke of Wellington's role as Commander-in-Chief of the Forces, is he by now an old man, I don't want to say resting on his laurels, but someone who has developed a fixed view of things? Or is he, I mean, you've mentioned some of the battles, some of the campaigns which are at least relatively successful during his period. Is he someone who actually has quite devolved command and allows others to take decisions?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, first of all, there is a really good recent study. The second volume of Rory Muir's biography of Wellington goes from 1815, including the coverage of the campaign of that year, to the end. So I think, and it's a big book, and I think I would refer people primarily to that. But what I would say, taking up my earlier point, is yes, one can find, if one likes, issues with Wellingtonian command, but I think that the frame of reference is a difficult one. People so often use the frame of reference of what is going to happen in the 1850s. I actually think if you're looking at the 1820s and 1830s, I'm not sure that's necessarily a terribly helpful framework for judging the ability of the British Army at that point. And as I said, I mean, the major role of the military is naval. The army only has limited resources. It doesn't have the size or scale of, for example, those of Austria or Russia. It is primarily an adjunct of the Navy for home defence and for transoceanic power projection. And it does that pretty well. You know, it does that pretty well. But obviously, tasking, as with any army, affects it. And the tasking of the Crimean War is a formidable challenge.
Is there a clear strategy through the 1820s to the early 1850s, which is led by the military, or is led by successive administrations at Westminster and Whitehall? So I suppose my question is it the top hats or the brass hats who are really driving military strategy, particularly as it relates to foreign policy?
Well, as you may know, I've written a book recently, a couple of books on strategy. And I think one of the problems with the discussion of strategy is so often people ignore the primacy of what I call tasking. And tasking is essentially politically set. There may well be a input from the military as to what is practical, but tasking is fundamentally politically set. So let me give you an example. In 1846, the British come close to war with America over the Oregon question. And obviously there are military preparations for this conflict, as far as the garrison in Canada is concerned, as far as warships in the Western Atlantic based on the port at Bermuda is concerned, and as far as British preparations in the Pacific are concerned. But essentially the entire crisis in terms of British policymaking is driven by the civilian politicians, who are reacting to what they see as an aggressive policy by President Polk, And his demand that, as it were, British Columbia should become part of America. The civilian politicians are willing to threaten war. The Americans become more reasonable, A, because they don't want to fight, so that to that respect, British force operates as a deterrent, and secondly, because they are more affected by the deteriorating relations and greater possibilities for America, deteriorating relations with Mexico. So in a sense, that, which is the major crisis, in my view, of that period, the late 1840s, is one that's entirely driven by, if you want to call it, civilian policymakers. It's civilian policymakers who determine whether Britain should or shouldn't go to war with Mehmed Ali of Egypt as he expands his forces in his territories into Syria. And this leads to, you know, British dispatch of forces to Acre, it leads to the British capture of Aden. You know, the military job is to execute here, but it's not the military that are sitting there in some bunker underneath horse guards saying to the Admiralty, saying to the government, we need to fight over this. I mean, that is not the way it is done. So I would say that a process. And remember, the civilian policymakers of these years are people who in a junior capacity had been there during the Napoleonic years. We're thinking of people like Aberdeen, for example, or Palmerston. So they have their own views on what is appropriate and possible. They have their own intentions and understandings of British strategy. And they're certainly not dependent on those who are military in order to have and to see how they should take these forward.
Well, Palmerston is obviously a politician very focused on foreign policy, but also someone who knows his own mind very clearly. Is it right to see the Palmerstonian age, which obviously coincides with the Crimean War, as a step change, or is it just another part of the process which should be seen on its own terms and doesn't establish new precedents?
Again, that's very interesting. Well, Palmerston dies in 1865 as Prime Minister, and by 1865, you've had much of, not complete, Italian unification, and you're starting to see the rise of Prussia. So Palmerston dies in the midst of, on the eve of, a very major and significant change in European power politics. But if you think of Palmerston as it were in his heyday, I think you would fairly say that Palmerston is a master of the act of the limited step. If it's like sit, speak softly and carry a big stick, the Teddy Roosevelt dictum, Palmerston knows how to use military displays and limited war in order to achieve British goals. The comparison also with George Washington, with another American leader, George Washington, is interesting because Palmerston's not really interested in entangling alliances. And I think he's quite effective. I mean, obviously, there are some crises in which he succeeds more than others. He finds it difficult to sustain relations with Napoleon III, though much of that is Napoleon III, up to Napoleon III. But yes, I think Palmerston is quite impressive. I mean, if you want to play the counterfactual, which I don't think here is terribly helpful, you could say that maybe Britain should have acted more vigorously towards the two powers, the issue of unification, for the two powers that are going to limit its options in the succeeding century, which is one, obviously, we've already mentioned, Germany and German unification. But the second one, of course, is the United States. There are war panics with the United States in 1861 and 1862. And there was the argument that, you know, Britain should recognize the Confederacy, seek to ensure trade with it, and be willing to risk a war with the Union accordingly. And you know, there were some figures who at the time or subsequently, Salisbury is one, who wondered whether Britain wouldn't have been better off fighting the Americans. But obviously that was not the policy pursued. So what one could argue is that Palmerston acts in within a limited parameter in using force, but certainly doesn't want a major war.
The Crimean War obviously comes as a rude shock. British forces out there have to learn various lessons, not just about generalship, but about fighting in difficult conditions. Are the lessons learned? Do things fundamentally change from that? Or actually, after the fighting's over, it's not until the reforms of the Gladstone years, the 1870s, the 1880s, the Cardwell and the Childers reforms, that really we see very significant structural change?
Well, it depends how you want to make this judgment. There are several different assessments of the Crimean War. There's the standard assessment, which focuses on the operations in Crimea. There's the alternative assessment, to which Andrew Lambert is the most important protagonist, which argues that the major British intention and focus was in fact on the naval forces sent into the Baltic, and that the reason these don't engage more attention is because the Russian fleet didn't want to come out and fight. Let's start with Crimea. The British are able to land their force and the French force successfully. They're able to sustain them. They mount the siege of Sevastopol. Russian attempts to cut the supply lines between the port at Balaclava and Sevastopol, the British lines at Sevastopol, fail. And in essence, the British in the end and the French succeed. Yes, there's been unfortunate casualties along the way, and they've shown the weaknesses of the British supply system. But I think it's fair to say that most of these have been sorted out the following year. So on the one hand, the British manage it. What you could ask is a slightly different question, which is how sensible was sending a force to Crimea? And there's several ways of looking at that. What precisely were they going to do? There was no way they were going to mount a main body invasion of a central area of Russia, as Napoleon had tried in 1812, or Charles XII of Sweden had tried in 1708-9, and indeed as Hitler was to try in 1941. They're hitting an ancillary target, focusing on the port at Sevastopol, which had proved the base of the Russian fleet that had smashed the Turkish Black Sea fleet off Sinope in 1853. And they succeed in that. It would have been a more conclusive victory if they'd managed likewise to force an engagement in the Gulf of Finland. But that's really quite a difficult task. And there is separate questions as to how well British warships would have manoeuvred in those shallow waters. So I'm not sure that one should focus on it on failure. I mean, you know, that's rather like taking the, you know, to argue that the British military failed in World War One and ignore the fact that actually Britain was a victor power and the Germans were defeated. In other words, there were lots of serious institutional, organisational failings. But, you know, they actually achieved their goals. Now, if you then ask the question, did they learn the lessons? Well, there was a measure of institutional improvement thereafter. In a way, there are other wars, the Indian Mutiny from 1857 to 1859, the Second Opium War, otherwise known as the Arrow War with China from 1857 to 1860. They're engaged in a whole host of struggles. And if anything, the Indian Mutiny was a much more serious struggle. It wasn't an optional struggle for Britain, as the Crimean War was. But they succeed in the Crimean War, they succeed in the Indian Mutiny, they succeed in the war in China, they succeed in defeating difficult opponents in the Maori Wars in New Zealand. So you could argue that in practical terms, they don't need the Cardwell reforms. I'm not sure I would be terribly happy with that view, because I think always it never hurts to have to, you know, be have one's processes stand up to scrutiny. But it would be wrong, as I've said already, to take the view that the early system was in some way redolent of failure, and hey presto, the Victorians wave a magic wand and it all gets better. I don't think that's helpful as an approach. I mean, it certainly reflects what the protagonists of those ideas said, but I mean, as you may know, there's quite a lot of work on the Cardwell reforms which argue that they weren't always as effective as their protagonists argued.
One of the impressions given about the Cardwell reforms is sometimes that it created, in effect, an imperial army, an army equipped to fight colonial wars. Is that true? I mean, after all, the British armed forces had been fighting from Burma to the northwest frontier to Africa, in Asia Pacific. At various stages throughout the 19th century, without waiting for the Cardwell reforms. How was it done before the Cardwell reforms, and how was it done afterwards?
Yes, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there were, the British Army had engaged in appreciable numbers in transoceanic warfare throughout the 18th century and in the early 19th century. So the Cardwell reforms to do with things like the organisation of recruitment, to do with things like how best to appoint and promote the officer corps, how to organise regiments. These are not measures that are necessary for Britain to act effectively outside British home waters. But your first point, I'd agree with entirely. The British Army is in many respects an imperial army. Britain does not occupy any part of Europe where there is significant military or civilian opposition. So the Ionian Islands are given up without a struggle to Greece. The majority of the Irish are loyal, and indeed a very large percentage of the British Army are Irish, Irish Catholics principally, but also Irish Protestants. When Cyprus is acquired in 1878, that doesn't mean there needs to be an occupation force holding down hostile locals, same in Malta. So the British Army's tasks are fundamentally those of imperial activity. In some areas, they can lessen this. In Canada, after 1871, after the Treaty of Washington of that year with the Americans, and after the establishment of the Dominion of Canada in 1867, the British pull their garrisons out of all bar two places, Halifax in Nova Scotia and Esquimalt in Vancouver Island, which are naval bases. And they say to the Canadians, up to you now, chaps. And so that, as it were, the system is changing. I mean, where the army is located changes, but there is a commonality in India, and for that matter in Egypt, and other areas as well, in that a significant portion of Britain's military commitment is taken up by non-British soldiers. And that tends to be forgotten. I mean, as you are aware, in the current so-called culture wars, there is a presentation of empire as some sort of alien British imposition on other societies in the world. That, of course, is rubbish. The imperial power is often just taking on the position of a previous imperial power, and all the local management and nuances and coalitions and alliances that involved. And you can see that with the British in India, you can see that with the British in Northeast Africa. So that if you're looking at the British campaigns in Sudan, both the 1885 unsuccessful relief of General Gordon in Khartoum and the conquest of Sudan, defeat of the Mahdists from 1895 to 1899, there are significant Egyptian forces as part of the British Army, and that is reflects the way that the British in Egypt are in part there as a new iteration of the power of the Egyptian Khedive. And you see the same process in India, of course, where the British had always been reliant on support from native forces and on alliances with native rulers. So I would say that it's continuity that seems to me to be the major theme rather than change.
Well, I mentioned a moment ago about recruiting local soldiers in the colonies. How did this work? The local British administration in each colony or territory raised, as it were, a local regiment, which was there primarily for policing and security issues until such time as things got serious? Or really, is the burden still on the regular army to get on a ship and sail out to wherever trouble is, and these local regiments are small militias that couldn't really fight successfully without support from the regular army?
No, I mean, the process is that what the historian R.G.S. Cooper, writing about India and the Maharatta Wars, called the military labour market in India, is one in which the British, to a considerable extent, in competition with others, but they take over much of the military labour market. So they are paying people. You know, the Indians that they're recruiting, they're paying them, and they're good soldiers. And they are certainly not lesser people, as it were. And when the British Indian Army is used elsewhere, for example, in China in the end of the 1850s into 1860, or in the expedition against Ethiopia, I mean, it's, you know, the British generals, people like Wolsey, are very keen to have Indian soldiers in the forces. So they will raise local men. The big distinction is whether they raise them themselves or whether they are produced by local allies as part of a larger force. So, you know, there are many Indian rulers, Maharaja of Kashmir, Nizam of Hyderabad, who are British allies. Some peoples whom the British have fought, the Gurkhas of Nepal, the Sikhs of the Punjab, who had, you know, shown and been brilliant fighters against the British, are then eagerly recruited by the British themselves. So I would, you know, I'm not in any way trying to disparage the quality of British units who go out elsewhere in the world. But I'm simply saying that if you're looking, for example, at Omdurman in 1898, the major battle in the defeat of the Mahdists in Sudan, yes, the British play a key role, British regiments play a key role, but so do, you know, Egyptian units are also important. But one of the interesting aspects of post-imperial history is that the role of non-British troops and support in empire has been elided out by states, peoples, you know, whatever, who are uncomfortable about it. Just as, for example, you know, the analogy is an interesting one. Anybody listening to a lot of people talking about the slave trade would think it was these harsh and ruthless Brits that turned up in Africa, seized people and took them off for slavery, which of course is rubbish. The slaves were seized by Africans and sold to the Brits. But the point is, it's as if there has to be an argument. In order to make imperialism incredibly evil, they need to create an argument in which agency doesn't exist for those people who participated quite actively in the imperial project who were non-British.
The presiding feeling back in London at this time is still to focus on the potential of a continental commitment, one that doesn't come despite scares, periodic scares with the French, and the colonial wars are things that come and go, but you know, isn't at the top of the, as it were, the hierarchy of needs. Or where is the balance between being ready to fight in Europe or smaller, more restricted encounters in Africa and Asia?
Oh, the British are not assuming that they would fight a significant land war in Europe. You're absolutely right. There are war panics with Russia, for example, in 1878, with France in 1898, with France again in the late 1850s, beginning of the 1860s. But the assumption in each of those cases is that the key action would be naval. So in 1878, there's the question of whether the British Navy would get to through the Dardanelles to Constantinople and help protect it against the Russians. In 1898, there's the question of what would happen in the Mediterranean if the British had a, as it were, slug out fight with the French whilst trying to protect the route to Egypt and the Suez Canal. So it was primarily naval. There wasn't any sense that Britain would be sending an army to the continent. And of course, when the Kingdom of Hanover is overrun in 1866 by the Prussians, the British do not provide any assistance to the King of Hanover, even though obviously he's related to the British royal family. Same with Denmark, when Denmark is attacked by the Prussians and Austrians in 1864.
So we come to the period of the scramble for Africa. To what extent, again, I guess this comes back to a question of what was planned and what was ad hoc made up on the spot according to needs. How would you describe the attitude in Whitehall of equipping the armed forces? And I'm talking about the Royal Navy as well as the army, in being ready to make Africa a primary theatre of operations?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I don't think Africa ever was a primary theatre of operations, apart from during the Boer War of 1899 to 1902. I think India, Southern Asia as a whole, because India is taken to include Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Burma, Pakistan, relations with Afghanistan, relations with Persia. I think India is almost always the forefront of British concerns, and it's from India that expeditions would tend to be sent to China or to North Borneo or to the East African coast. So it's not, I would say, I don't wish to be disparaging, but compared to concern about what's going on the northwest frontier of India, very few people care much about what's happening in Sierra Leone. And I think one has to get this in perspective. I mean, all too much of writing of history is often bilateral. In other words, somebody writes their dissertation or their book based on their dissertation on, shall we say, French policy in Madagascar at the background of the French conquest in the mid-1890s. And then they build up by that to show that in their eyes, Madagascar is the key imperial issue. Well, that would have surprised anybody interested at that time or working on subsequently on the French in Algeria or growing French concerns about Morocco or French commitments in Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth. So I would say that, yes, the British are interested in the scramble for Africa, but it's very specific interests. Egypt is important because of the route to India, the Suez Canal, concern about the French establishing themselves there. Sudan becomes interesting as a traditional area of Egyptian expansion and also to prevent the Mahdist rebellion there against Egyptian overlordship, as it were, producing a tsunami of protest and difficulty along the Nile. South Africa, the Cape Colony is important as the other route to India, but not everybody are interested in expansionism into the interior of Southern Africa, and that is an episodic matter which occurs at some periods more than others. In West Africa, again, the presence is patchy. I mean, the British go into Lagos essentially, in order to stop the slave trade. But there isn't some master plan that the British must run large chunks of Western Africa. So I think one needs a measure of caution here. And as far as the British government is concerned, a lot of their military commitments are reactive. In other words, in Sudan against the Mahdists, South Africa becomes more important when the Zulus are an issue in the late 1870s, and when the Boers are an issue first in the early 1880s, first Boer War 1881, and then again in the late 1890s. But there isn't the same degree of determination. There isn't certainly the wide-ranging determination that you see with the French, who in a way have to construct their empire in Africa because they've lost their first empire in the 18th century and under Napoleon. That's not the same dynamic for Britain, I would say. And a lot of British imperial expansion vis-a-vis other European powers in part is a matter of responding to them. So, for example, the British go into upper Burma in 1885 because they're worried about French expansionism from what we would now call North Vietnam. The British are concerned about southern Sudan because they're worried about French expansion from the area of Chad. The British are concerned about what we would call Zimbabwe because they're worried about German expansion from German Southwest Africa. The British are concerned in Kenya because they're worried about German expansion from German, what we would call Tanganyika, German East Africa. So in part, it's reaction and action. And the scramble for Africa, so-called, is largely motivated not by some sort of racist hatred of Africans. It's actually primarily another aspect of the European confrontations. But the interesting point is that after 1871, between then and 1914, the major powers are particularly apt to do that competition, as it were, by second hand. It's like the Cold War being waged as a struggle for influence in parts of Central America, the Caribbean, the Middle East, and Southern Asia. So there wasn't this great concern to send British regiments to fight hither and thither across the map of Africa.
I was very interested in something you said a few minutes ago about India as a garrison and a base for operations elsewhere, either in Asia Pacific, obviously on the northern frontier, with the great game in Russia, but also elsewhere. And I wonder whether you could just give a sense of the weight of forces and resources, how significant India was, not just in terms of holding India, but how central forces based in India were to the wider scheme of global British operations.
I think that's a very good question. I think India was seen as absolutely crucial to Britain's global role. And it leads the British possibly to become disproportionately anxious about Russia, because the practicality was that the ability of Russia to project its power through Central Asia, areas like Bukhara, Samarkand, Tashkent, Khiva, and to project that to, through Afghanistan, to the Northwest frontier, I think that would have been astonishingly difficult. I mean, you get crises, the Penjda crisis in 1885, and people are talking about, how Russian approaches to the northern frontier of Afghanistan might be the cause of war between Britain and Russia. I've actually been to Afghanistan. People have got absolute, they were drawing lines on a map without having any idea about the difficulties of communication across these. So I think to a certain extent, the British exaggerated the threat to their position in South Asia. And you could argue, if you like, might have been better advised devoting more attention to other spheres. But on the other hand, you could say, well, they had these possessions in India, they had a significant army there, much of it Indian. It was easiest to use by, chasing Alfredis and others around the Swat and places on the Northwest frontier.
the opening and control of the Suez Canal, that makes India more important as a base for operations, or that, you know, troops from India can move around, or less important in the sense that troops from Britain can move through the Mediterranean, through the Suez Canal, to wherever they are deployed?
Well, certainly the latter and also the former. I mean, troops from India go to Cyprus and Malta during the 1877-1878 crisis with a confrontation with Russia. Britain doesn't have vast numbers of troops to send to the Indian Ocean, and also there would have been big issues with disease had they done so. But the Suez Canal is important. I mean, obviously it cuts the time it's going to take in order to get to India and beyond India, to China, to Australasia, to Malaya. And from that point of view, it's significant. It's important as a trading link, which I think is more so almost than it's important strategically. But obviously, you know, the Suez Canal makes sense once you have steam power. I mean, as you may know, navigating in the Red Sea with by sail was not easy because of the local conditions, sailing conditions. But once you have steam power, and of course you have the availability of coaling stations, and once you've acquired Aden, Aden becomes a very important bunkering station for British ships, then it does, yes, it's a geopolitical axis, but it's not as though the British necessarily have to send vast numbers of troops in that direction.
The Second Boer War, 1899-1902, does that mark an end of a phase in British imperial military strategy? You know, the British win, similar to the Crimean War. You know, the British are on the winning side in the end, but you know there are a lot of bloody noses to get. Then it's a difficult war. You know, fought with guerrilla tactics and all the rest of it. Should we just see that Boer War in isolation, or does it actually mark some wider turning point?
Again, an excellent question. I mean, it certainly led to anxiety in Britain about British effectiveness. It leads to a debate about whether conscription should be introduced, and that helps to be the background to the discussion of yeomanry regiments and the Territorial Army. It also contributes to the debate that you see in the 1900s encompassing both Conservatives and Liberals as to whether the British are in some way degenerate and need to be strengthened, the, as it were, a kind of social Darwinianism in which the idea is that empire, the Boy Scouts, social welfare will all help to make the British a fitter stock and therefore able to take on this challenge. So yes, there are questions. The practicality, first of all, the British did badly in the initial stages, not new. I mean, after all, they'd been beaten by the Afghans at Maywand in 1880, where John Watson in the Sherlock Holmes stories gets a bullet. They'd been beaten by these Zulus at Islandwanda in just before that, 1879. So yes, they do badly in the initial stages, very badly. They don't appreciate the extent to which the Boer weaponry, smokeless powder, use of Mauser rifles, long-range sniping is going to, as it were, hit British forces deployed in the open. They don't appreciate the degree to which mounted infantry give the Boer operational mobility. And of course, the Boer have the initiative, take the attack, and that gives them great advantages. And, you know, as you get the sieges of British positions, you get, you know, Black Week, all the rest of it. It's worth bearing in mind the British very rapidly rally. Obviously their positions hold. So just as Lucknow had held in the Indian Mutiny, so Ladysmith and Mafeking hold. They get some good generals deployed with more troops. So Kitchener, who'd conquered Sudan, and Roberts, who had marched to the relief of Kandahar in the Second Anglo-Afghan War, who are the two best generals available. They deploy a lot of manpower, put up taxation accordingly. And, you know, in 1900, British troops take the major settlements, the major positions, Bloemfontein, Pretoria, Johannesburg. I mean, and thereafter, it's really a guerrilla war, which it's difficult to do much about, as with the nature of guerrilla wars. But the Boers certainly aren't winning, and the British are in control of most positions, and it's just a question of how to find an outcome. They've also deterred other powers from intervening, particularly and specifically Germany. Which had thought of doing so. So no, in that respect, I think you could argue it was a success. And in strategic terms, the British become the dominant power in southern Africa. That gives them access to and control over a major source of bullion, which is very important, is to be very important in World War One. And despite the degree to which a certain number of Afrikaners in World War One and to a lesser extent in World War Two are treasonable, and in World War One a certain small number of them support the Germans in Southwest Africa, nevertheless, the bulk of South Africa is loyal in both World War One and World War Two, and provides significant numbers of troops for the British Empire, whether it's, for example, operating in East Africa, whether against the Germans in World War One, whether it's helping to capture Madagascar from Vichy France in 1942, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say in strategic terms, it's a success. Most military commentators, particularly in the general public, unfortunately don't understand strategy, wouldn't know it if they saw it. So most people tend to think of things in tactical terms, or at best operational. And from that perspective, it isn't brilliant. I mean, high costs are taken in order to take part in the learning curve to victory, but the learning curve is achieved. So, I don't think you could argue fairly that it showed the British in a disastrous position. I mean, there's no real equivalent to the abysmal failure of the Italians at Adowa in 1896, when they're smashed by Menelik II of Ethiopia, and that's the end of the Italian attempt to conquer Ethiopia until 1935, 1936. There's no equivalent to the abysmal disaster of the Russians against the Japanese in 1905. So there's no attempt equivalent to the failure of the Spaniards in Cuba against the Americans in 1898. So I think one's got to contextualize this. People aren't good at contextualizing things. I was recently did a debate on the video for, I think, Intelligence Squared, and the chairperson, it was about empire, and the chairperson, I was, as it were, in to talk about British Empire, it was being castigated. I said, well, you've got to see things in the broader context. And the chairperson said, oh, well, that's just what algebra. And I said, actually, it's called context. And if you don't understand context, you can't make judgments. So I said, I would say if you're looking at the context of what is going on at this period, I would not put the emphasis on British failure. If you want to look at other failures of that period, you could think of the Chinese, the Boxer failure in China in 1900, the relief of the legations. You can go on and on and on. So on the whole, the British are still militarily very, very successful. I mean, in Africa as a whole, as we've already mentioned, they've crushed the Mahdists in Sudan. They've defeated their opponents in modern day Zimbabwe. They're about, at the beginning of the 20th century, to conquer northern Nigeria. And I think, I'd like on the next programme to move on to World War One. I think we can call it a pause here. But I think what one needs to do is to understand that the general tendency to, I'm not saying you're doing this, Graham, but the general tendency to rubbish the British past, to write down achievements, is all too easy. And it doesn't help us make judgments about how people are doing in comparative terms. So let's continue this next week. Looking at World War One, and I think we've covered quite a lot of ground today.
We've covered a lot of ground, a lot of territories, and a lot of years. Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.